ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Qantas hit with a $90 million fine for unlawfully sacking workers during the pandemic. Also, Europe's most powerful leaders join Volodymyr Zelensky in Washington for his meeting with Donald Trump. And a country mechanic donates his time and skills to help the disadvantaged get a set of wheels.
You can't help but want to help these young people, you know, and become a small part of their life. And I tell them, you've become a small part of my family now, and like it or not, that's forever.
In a significant industrial relations ruling, the federal court has ordered Qantas pay a penalty of $90 million for illegally sacking workers during the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2020, the country's largest airline decided to outsource the jobs of more than 1,800 employees, including baggage handlers and ground staff. In his judgment today, Justice Michael Lee observed that Qantas had been more worried about the company than its workers. Kimberly Price reports.
5 years ago, Don Dixon was part of the Qantas Airlines staff, but the COVID-19 pandemic wreaked havoc on the aviation industry. The then CEO of Qantas, Alan Joyce, made the decision to sack 1,800 staff members and outsource the jobs of baggage handlers, ground staff and other skilled workers.
It was traumatic. We did lose our job. None of us are young. You know, it's difficult to getting a job at our age now. Most people are in their 60 or above.
Along with the other sacked Qantas staff, Don Dixon turned to the Transport Workers Union for help.
5 years we've been taken from federal courts to full benches to the High Court, back here with appeals just non-stop. You know, one would think we were some sort of a pinball. That's the only way I can describe it, you know. Qantas had the ping pong machine and we just kept bouncing around.
A court had previously found Qantas's move to outsource the jobs of more than 1,800 staff was illegal. Today, the federal court handed down a landmark penalty of $90 million. Michael Kane is a Transport Workers Union National Secretary.
This was an egregious wrong that had to be righted. It is a significant, the most significant industrial outcome in Australia's history. And it sends a really clear message to Qantas and to every employer in Australia. Treat your workforce illegally and you will be held accountable.
Justice Michael Lee said Qantas had shown the, quote, wrong kind of sorry and worried more about the impact on the company rather than the impact on its workers.
To deprive someone of work illegally is to deprive someone of an aspect of their human dignity, and this is not assuaged simply by mouthing expressions of regret.
In his ruling, Justice Lee said $50 million of the penalty would be paid to the Transport Workers Union. Dan Trindad is an industrial relations lawyer and believes that decision will deter other businesses from making the same mistake.
To say, well, I'm going to resource a union to be able to take these kind of claims on against a large, well-resourced employer.
However, Dan Trindad is not sure the fine will go down as a failure on Qantas' record after the airline saved a huge amount of money through the outsourcing.
The whole episode has probably cost them $240 million, $120 million in agreed compensation, probably about $30 million plus in their own legal fees, and now a $90 million penalty. If someone was just doing a pure sort of number crunching exercise, they had a $500 million cost saving on one hand and a $240 million outlay on the other side. It probably still works as a business decision.
Helen Bird is a senior lecturer at Swinburne University's School of Law. She believes the decision diminishes former CEO Alan Joyce's already controversial legacy as the Qantas chief.
He would justify his actions by was survival and the resilience of the company during difficult periods, particularly COVID. But the short answer is that a governance review at the time and subsequently has shown that really he operated in, it was my way or the highway type of approach. So he's still left with a very significant bonus, which is, I think, callable into question now.
In the wake of the decision, Helen Bird thinks current Qantas CEO, Vanessa Hudson, faces a tough job to rebuild the company's standing.
I understand that she says she focuses on improving or rebuilding that trust, and that means both with workers and the customer base. But airfares are still sky high. Services are still very much criticised. I mean, yes, I gather things are underway, but there's a lot of work to do and Qantas at the moment is profiting.
However, Helen Bird does believe the federal court's decision will serve as a caution to other Australian businesses.
Most Australian companies do actually want to do the right thing, and I think it's a very large warning sign what happens when you don't. And I do wonder going forward if Qantas has fully assessed the true cost of this event.
The court will decide at another hearing how the remaining $40 million of Qantas's $90 million fine will be shared.
Kimberly Price reporting. Ahead of his meeting with Donald Trump in just a few hours' time, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has declared it's up to Vladimir Putin to end the war. His statement comes after Mr. Trump claimed on social media that Mr. Zelensky could end the conflict if he wanted to. Following the Trump-Putin meeting on the weekend, many observers are concerned the American president will demand Ukraine give up territory. As Luke Radford reports, unlike his last visit to the White House, this time Mr. Zelensky will have European leaders in his corner.
Last time Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was in the Oval Office to discuss the war with Russia, it turned into a shouting match.
Military equipment, you and your men are brave, but they had to use our military.
Yes. What about
if you didn't have you our military
me.
Equipment,
you invited
if
me
you didn't
speak.
Have our military equipment, this war would have been over in 2 weeks.
In three days. I heard it from Putin. In 3 days.
Tonight, he'll have backup from some of Europe's most powerful leaders. It's an extraordinary list, including French President Emmanuel Macron, UK PM Sir Keir Starmer, and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. French President Emmanuel Macron says there's a lot at stake for the future of Europe.
Ultimately, what we are saying is that we want peace. Everyone who will be there tomorrow in Washington has been on the side of peace from day one. But we want a robust peace, a peace that in no way can be a capitulation, a peace that in no way can be at the expense of the security of Europeans.
Achieving that peace may be difficult, given one of the key Russian demands is for Ukraine to give up parts of its territory. Russia currently holds about a fifth of Ukraine, primarily in the Luhansk and Donetsk regions in the country's east. But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made it clear that giving away land is not an option.
Russia is still unsuccessful in Donetsk region. Putin has been unable to take it for 12 years. And the constitution of Ukraine makes it impossible to give up territory or trade land. Since the territorial issue is so important, it should be discussed only by the leaders of Ukraine and Russia at the trilateral Ukraine, United States, Russia.
Something that's almost certain to be part of the debate is the question of security guarantees. Ukraine wants to join the NATO Defence Alliance, something Russia is adamantly opposed to. But the US now says Vladimir Putin has agreed to a potential workaround to allow the US and Europe to offer Ukraine a potential NATO-style defence arrangement without actually being in NATO. Here's Donald Trump's special envoy to Russia, Steve Witkoff.
Part of the discussion that we're going to have on Monday throughout the day is exactly the specifics of what the Ukrainians feel that they need. Because remember, as mediators, we were at this summit to advance the Ukrainian position, and we did that, and we did it successfully. Now it's for us to drill down on the granular details of exactly what the Ukrainians need.
So what can we expect from the White House talks? Dr. Jessica Gnauer is a senior lecturer in international relations at Flinders University.
I think that we won't actually know how important this meeting is until after we see what comes out of it. So it could be that out of this meeting, Trump essentially tries to pressure President Zelensky to give up Ukrainian territory. President Zelensky says that's not something that he's willing to do, and it's not something the Ukrainian people are willing to do. And then we don't really get any clear outcome out of the meeting, except for maybe a promise from Trump that he's going to try to have another meeting with Putin.
However, there is another outcome, one that would be far more favourable to Ukraine.
If out of this meeting, Trump comes out with a very clear understanding that he would push for Russia agreeing to a ceasefire on the ground, even if that's a short-term ceasefire, and that then the Trump administration actually pressures Russia to agree to a ceasefire with something like the threat of secondary sanctions that's already been floated, then yes, it would be a very significant meeting.
If a peace deal is agreed to, it's likely to include international peacekeeping troops and potentially Australians. Here's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese speaking on Sky News.
If there is a peace and if there is a global response to that in the form of peacekeeping, then we would consider any proposal at the time. That would be a matter for the Cabinet.
The meeting between President Zelensky and Trump is set to take place in the early hours of tomorrow morning, Australian time.
Luke Radford. In the AFL, Adelaide Crows star Isaac Rankin is being investigated for allegedly using a homophobic slur during the team's match against Collingwood on Saturday night. If found guilty, he'll be the third AFL player banned for such comments this season. The league is vowing to keep hitting players with harsh penalties to stamp out homophobia, but some advocates say the sanctions won't work on their own. Angus Randall prepared this report.
He's the motor of this team. Isaac Rankin, the Crows' best player, puts it on show again.
Isaac Rankin has been lighting up the Adelaide Oval this season as the Crows make their push towards finals. He could be set for a long stint on the sidelines if found guilty by the AFL Integrity Unit over an alleged homophobic slur against a Collingwood player on Saturday night. Crows captain Jordan Dawson remained tight-lipped outside club headquarters.
Oh, I mean, it's not ideal, but it's obviously in the AFL's hands and we'll let them investigate it and see what happens.
Across town, Port Adelaide captain Connor Rosie wouldn't comment on the alleged Rankin incident, but says it's an area for the AFL to improve.
As a competition and an industry in general, it's a space that we still need to improve on as individuals and as clubs, and we need to make sure it's inclusive for absolutely everyone, players and fans.
Isaac Rankin could be suspended for the rest of the season, meaning he'd miss his first ever finals series and the Crows' first since 2017. Hayley Conway is the CEO of Pride Cup, which promotes inclusion in professional and community sporting clubs. She says the league is showing it's serious about stamping out homophobia.
What's important is that the incident is being investigated appropriately, taken seriously by the relevant parties, the clubs and the AFL, and that an appropriate sanction, if it's required, if the incident is upheld, is seen through.
The AFL has kept ramping up the punishments for homophobic comments. Last year, incidents were treated with a 3-game suspension. This year, it's been up to 6. Dr. Ryan Storr is from the Swinburne Sport Innovation Research Group. He says it will take more than bans to stamp it out.
No, I think it's a band-aid solution. I think it needs to be addressed culturally within the sport. I think this kind of approach of just increasing the ban doesn't seem to be working, because I would argue as well, why is it particularly homophobic language they're using? Like, of all the things that you could say in the heat of the moment, why is it always homophobic words? So I think there's a culture that needs to be addressed in it.
His research from last year showed homophobia remains a challenge across all levels of sport. Dr. Storr found around 53% of young LGBT plus people experienced or witnessed discrimination in community sport, but that number jumps to 76% amongst gay men.
Is it sport? Is it society? It's a combination of both, but I think unfortunately sport is prime for this, because the main perpetrators of homophobia in particular are young teenage boys in groups. So sport as a setting is a key avenue for this.
And while players like Crows forward Darcy Fogarty say they get enough education...
Yeah, I can we definitely get enough.
Dr. Ryan Storr worries it's not getting through.
I think what it kind of shows is that these men are using these phrases and terms in the heat of the moment, and it's maybe the first thing that they might use. So I think it highlights that there's a culture within these team sports that homophobia and homophobic language is normalized and is actually quite frequent. And obviously all the research that I've been doing over the years has shown that. And I think we're kind of seeing it now at that level.
There are no openly gay players in the AFL. However, these clubs all share facilities with their AFLW sides, where LGBT plus identity is both normalized and celebrated in an annual pride round. Dr. Storr is concerned the positive level of inclusion in the women's comp is shielding the men from accountability.
I think, unfortunately, the AFL in particular view, and maybe some people in the community level view, the men's and the women's competition as very, very separate products. The women have the pride round, for example, and whenever they've done media, it's always the women doing the hard work. So I think, unfortunately, in the past, the AFL in particular have relied on the women's side to do the heavy lifting, and now they can't kind of get away from it anymore because it's specifically in the men's competition that we keep having these problems.
He can empathise with Crows fans and those who want to see the most talented players on the field, but says every new case of homophobia risks turning people off the game.
But I think we really need to revisit and kind of reinforce the fact that we want everybody to be able to enjoy the football and to be able to go and watch it in the stadiums and to follow it. And this type of language that just isn't going away is stopping people from actively engaging and playing and things like that. So I think it's for the benefit of everybody in the game that we address this problem.
The AFL says it's investigating the allegations against Isaac Rankin, with no timeline in place for an outcome.
Angus Randall reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a grieving dad honours his son by repairing used cars and giving them to the needy. The chair of the Productivity Commission, Danielle Wood, has told the National Press Club today she's optimistic the federal government's economic reform roundtable will lead to change. The three-day summit, hosted by the federal treasurer, starts in Canberra tomorrow and will include business and union leaders, politicians and experts. Productivity is a major issue on the agenda. A simple definition of the term is that it's about producing more with less input or effort, and that in turn delivers an economic boost that improves the lives of everyone. Diana Damjanovic reports.
The word productivity is being thrown around a lot lately, with pretty much everyone agreeing it's growing too slowly. But one expert says before we start trying to fix the problem, we need to make sure we know what the problem is.
My concern is we are rapidly jumping into solution mode.
Warren Hogan is the chief economic advisor at Judo Bank.
They're looking at company tax cuts. They're looking at regulatory change, this sort of stuff. And all these ideas are piling in. I would actually like the group of economic leaders that are gathering in Canberra this week to focus on the problem. Don't go straight to solution mode. Make sure you're solving for the right problem, because I don't think they are.
For Mr. Hogan, Australia's productivity problem is largely caused by our changing population.
So the baby boomer generation was not only a bulge of young kids coming out after World War II, it saw a massive increase in the supply of labour, workers coming into our economy through the 1970s, 80s and 90s. And what that effectively meant was that we had an abundance of labour. You know, the labour force was growing quicker than the economy. And the problem was giving everyone a job. So unemployment was the issue. And of course, that means the opposite. That means every year we're getting less working age people coming into the economy compared to the size of it. And of course, it's the people that create the goods and services for the broader population. And of course, it's the population that represents the demand for those goods and services. So we've got to understand what that means. And I don't think that understanding is there.
He says as baby boomers begin to hit retirement age, the problems have emerged.
We are now seeing the working age population as a share of the economy fall after persistently rising for 40 years.
One leader whose input will be front and centre at the economic roundtable is Australia's Productivity Commissioner, Danielle Wood. She says falling productivity means today's youngsters are on track to have a lower standard of living than their parents did.
That expectation that life will get better for each successive generation is Australia's generational bargain. And for many generations, we have fulfilled that promise. Until perhaps now. Overwhelmingly today, young people believe that they won't live better lives than their parents did. And as chair of the Productivity Commission, I'm worried too.
In a speech to the National Press Club in Canberra today, Danielle Wood outlined her priorities for the three-day roundtable. They include slashing the corporate tax rate from 30 to 20% for businesses who turn over less than $1 billion per year, increasing participation in training, considering a national carbon price to reduce emissions, And she says governments need to make sure they don't overregulate the rising artificial intelligence sector and the opportunity it presents. For economist Warren Hogan, harnessing technology such as AI and quantum computing is at the core of the solution.
This is the silver bullet. This is how we solve it. And unfortunately, a lot of the debate is coming from the wrong angle. It's coming from the defensive. And maybe that's our history. But it is this technology which is going to augment our relatively shrinking labour supply to help provide the goods and services that we need in our community. And of course, that's the definition of productivity, using this technology to make everyone more efficient and produce more for every hour they're on the job.
Warren Hogan is the Chief Economic Advisor at Judo Bank. That report from Diana Damjanovic. The death of a loved one in a car accident is a tragedy that often stays with families for the rest of their lives. In country Victoria, one father has found a unique way to honour his son. Gavin Hynam repairs used cars and gives them to disadvantaged people in his community. The 64-year-old has handed over 19 sets of keys so far and has no plans to stop. Kathleen O'Connor prepared this story.
Brake could do with a little bit of fluid. Everything else looks pretty good, though.
There aren't many people in the regional Victorian town of Horsham who don't know this man.
My name's Gavin Hynam. Most people know me as Bear. I'm 64 years old and have been living in Horsham here for 31 years.
Gavin's a farmer and a qualified mechanic who lost his 20-year-old son Preston in a car crash 17 years ago. Since then, he's been teaching young people how to drive safely once they get their learner's permit.
The program is to help young people get their driving experience and their 120 hours to get their full licence and turn them into confident and safe drivers when they're let loose out on the road.
While they were on the road together, he'd hear their stories, and that brought into sharp focus just how tough some of their lives were.
I thought to myself, how about start helping some of these young people in the community by giving them their first car? I gave away two cars to two young asylum seeker men, and then there was a migrant lady from South America. She got a car, so she was the third one. And then I thought, no, I'd said to my family, I'm going to give away two cars this year to the young people that I'm teaching.
8 years on, he's fixed 19 used cars and gifted them to people in need, spending $20,000 of his own money.
These young people, they've mostly come from a tough background, generally for no reason of their own, which just sort of helps. You can't just help but want to help these young people, you know, and become a small part of their life. And I tell them, you've become a small part of my family now, and like it or not, that's forever.
One of the people Gavin fixed up a car for was 23-year-old single mother Caitlin Summerfield.
You get one free service with the car, so when the sticker says, you know, it's time for an oil change, I'll get involved, it'll be on the hoist there, and we'll change the oil and fill it for you.
Okay.
And now I can run my eyes over the car for you.
Ms Summerfield's daughter Harper has a disability, so getting to and from appointments can be a challenge.
We just don't go out as much because, you know, it's hard to get around. She's four, torn train at the moment, so she can't walk too far.
When Harper's NDIS support coordinator, Kylie Zanka, learned the distances the pair would be walking, she realised a solution was needed.
Caitlin had mentioned that she needed to get Harper to a kindergarten way over the other side of Horsham, and I could hear the distress in her voice. She didn't have a car, she didn't know how she was going to get there.
She called the man they call Bear, who swung into action.
When we leave here today, we'll go to Vic Roads. I'll transfer it into your name. I've got the paperwork there. I hope you've got your licence with you.
Yeah.
We'll send you on your way.
It's a similar story for 18-year-old high school student Chelsea Robinson. The teenager is 6 weeks away from graduating from high school, and after a year of driving lessons with Bear, she's graduated from her L's to her P's.
We connected through a lot of different ways. It wasn't just about the driving. It was about, like, building those connections and getting to know people as well.
Chelsea hasn't had contact with their parents since she was six and now lives with her older brother. The help Bear has given her has put her in the driver's seat of her own life.
I had a very rough upbringing as well, so definitely having Bear there, it's been a great experience.
Bear hopes what he's doing makes his son proud.
Preston's not with us anymore. I know there's nothing we can do to bring him back, but I also know there's lots of things we can do in his memory. So I draw the strength from him, and that's what keeps me going.
Horsham farmer and qualified mechanic Gavin Hynam. That report from Kathleen O'Connor and Tamara Clark. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi there, it's Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. In April, China installed more solar panel than Australia has throughout history. China is also now home to half of the world's wind power and half of the world's electric cars. Today, climate reporter Joe Lauder on how the Communist Party managed to electrify the nation so quickly. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.